The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Doris Hyde for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Vision News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from BigThink.com, Genetic Blindness Treatment. From PCMagazine.com, Audacity is now spyware. From NBC News, hackers lock out over a million devices. From TweakTown.com, iOS Update 14.6 is killing battery life. From the NNO, North Carolina sues Google Play. And if I have a chance, Ozzie Howell rates Canes. So let's get started. From BigThink.com, Penn scientists correct genetic blindness with single injection into the eye. Antisense oligonucleotide therapy uses small molecules to alter RNA. Researchers have now used those molecules to alleviate a genetic form of blindness by B. David Zarley. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania have reversed a genetic form of blindness in a patient using just one course of antisense oligonucleotide therapy, clinical OMICS reports. The therapy, which takes aim at mutant RNA, was injected into the patient's eyes a year ago in a trial treating Leber congenital amaurosis, LCA. LCA predominantly affects the retina, leaving people with severely impaired vision from birth, according to the NIH. The trial, held at the SCHEIEI Institute at Penn's Perelman School of Medicine, focused on using antisense oligonucleotide therapy to treat LCA patients with one of the disease's most common mutations, augmenting RNA. Antisense oligonucleotide therapy works by altering the RNA, the messenger that carries instructions from your DNA to crank out proteins. An article in Nature Reviews Neurology describes antisense oligonucleotides as short, synthetic, single-strand molecules, which can alter RNA to cause protein creation to be reduced, enhanced, or modified. In the Penn study, the targeted protein was created by the mutated LCA gene. The team, led by Professors Artur V. Cidicyan, that's C-I-D-E-C-I-Y-A-N, and Samuel G. Jacobson, injected an antisense oligonucleotide called sepofarsen, S-E-P-O-F-A-R-S-E-N, into the eyes of 11 patients. In a previous study, according to the Clinical Omics, the team had shown that administering the therapy every 3 months increased the amount of the proper protein levels in 10 patients' eyes, improving their sight in daytime conditions. But it's the experience of the 11th patient that's the subject of their new paper, published in Nature Medicine. One shot. That 11th patient chose to receive only one course of sepofarsen and turned down the additional doses. The patient had suffered from poor visual acuity, reduced fields of view, and zero night vision, clinical omics reports. But after one shot, the patient showed remarkable improvement over the course of the next 15 months, similar to people who got multiple regular injections. Our results set a new standard of what biological improvements are possible with antisense oligonucleotide therapy in LCA caused by CEP290 mutations, Cidicyan told Clinical Omics. Interestingly, the effects of the shot had a delayed onset. While improvement was shown after 1 month, the gains peaked around 3 months later. The authors write, "That slow uptake was unexpected, and it may hold insights into treating other diseases that impact retinal cell cilia, a.k.a. those little vibrating hairs, the physical cause of LCA. Antisense oligonucleotide therapy may be effective because the tiny molecules can slip inside the cell's nucleus, but don't get swept out too quickly, so they can stick around until the job's done. The therapy's success and the unexpected success of a single injection is inspiring other clinical trials. There are now, at least in the eye field, a series of clinical trials using antisense oligonucleotides for different genetic defects spawned by the success of the work in CEP290-associated LCA from Drs. Cidicyan and Jacobson. Joan O'Brien, chair of ophthalmology and director of the Shai Eye Institute, told Clinical Omics. Multiple antisense therapies have already been approved by the FDA, particularly for neurological conditions, and have shown success in treating spinal muscular atrophy, and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Per Neurology Genetics, antisense oligonucleotide therapy trials are currently being developed for Huntington's, Parkinson's, and Alzheimer's disease, among others. And now, add genetic blindness to that list. This work represents a really exciting direction for RNA antisense therapy. It's been 30 years since there were new drugs using RNA antisense oligonucleotides, Jacobson told Clinical Omics, even though everybody realized that there were great promise for these treatments. Related articles on the web are at hot links at the end of the article. From PCMag.com, Audacity, now spyware. Original story, July 5th. Anyone deciding to download the free and open source audio editor, Audacity, is being warned that the software may now class as spyware due to recent updates to its privacy policy. Audacity is a popular audio editing software tool that's been around for over 21 years. On April 30th, the Muse Group acquired Audacity with the promise that the software would remain forever free and open source. However, as FOSS Post reports, last week the Audacity privacy policy page was updated to add a number of personal data collection clauses. The data collected includes OS version and name, user country based on IP address, the CPU being used, data related to Audacity error codes and crash reports, and finally, data necessary for law enforcement, litigation, and authority requests, if any. The personal data collected can be shared with Muse Group employees based in Russia, auditors, advisors, legal representatives, and similar agents, potential company buyers, and any competent law enforcement body, regulatory, government agency, court, or third party where we believe disclosure is necessary as a matter of applicable law or regulation, or to exercise, establish, or defend our legal rights. It's also stated that personal data is stored on servers in the European Economic Area, EEA, but that we are occasionally required to share your personal data with our main office in Russia and our external counsel in the USA. As you'd expect, the collection of personal data, the potential for it to be shared with law enforcement, regulators, and government, as well as there being the option to transfer it to Russia, has angered a lot of people. This is clear from visiting the Audacity GitHub and Reddit pages, and there are now calls to fork the software in order to revert back to a policy of not collecting such data from users who simply want to edit audio using the free software. Muse Group did not immediately respond to a request for comment, but it tells Music Radar that the controversy is overblown and due largely to unclear phrasing of the updated privacy policy. Data will not be shared with third parties and only basic data will be collected, it says. On Twitter, Muse also retweeted an article that seeks to debunk the FOSS Post report. There's an update as of the 6th. Audacity owner Muse Group has now responded to the spyware claims via the Audacity GitHub page with a clarification of privacy policy post. According to Daniel Ray, head of strategy at Muse, we believe concerns are due largely to unclear phrasing in the privacy policy, which we are now in the process of rectifying. We are working with our legal team to revise our privacy policy to more clearly communicate the above points and our intent. Ray then spends time clarifying each of the clauses in the new privacy policy that caused so much concern, and also points out that this version of the policy doesn't actually come into force until the next release of Audacity 3.0.3, so it doesn't apply to the current 3.0.2 version people are using. Responses to the post on GitHub suggest trust between Muse Group and the Audacity community has already broken down. The top comment by TeachAndMusic462 is a reflection of this, stating, quote, after the telemetry, CLA, and now this, do you expect any trust from the community? Muse still does not understand open source software at a fundamental level. I am holding out for a fork to gain momentum and will stay on a pre-Muse Audacity until then. Muse Group is expecting to publish a revised version of the Audacity privacy policy in oncoming days. From NBCNews.com, hackers behind holiday crime spree demand $70 million, say they locked 1 million devices. Cybersecurity experts say the scale of the attack is unprecedented for criminal hackers. Kevin Collier is a reporter covering cybersecurity, privacy, and technology policy for NBC News. Posted July 5th and updated on the 6th, the hacker gang behind an international crime spree that played out over the 4th of July weekend says it has locked more than 1 million individual devices and is demanding $70 million in Bitcoin to set them all free in one swoop. The gang, the Russia-connected R-Evil, is best known for previously having hacked JBS, one of the world's largest meat suppliers, briefly halting its operations across much of North America. But this attack's potential scope is unprecedented, some cybersecurity experts said. R-Evil began its spree Friday by compromising Kaseya, a software company that helps companies manage basic software updates. Kaseya is spelled K-A-S-E-Y-A. Because many of Kaseya's customers are companies that manage internet services for other businesses, the number of victims grew quickly. Instead of locking an individual organization as ransomware gangs usually do, R-Evil locked each victim computer as a standalone target and initially asked for $45,000 to unlock each one. President Joe Biden told reporters Sunday that he has directed the full resources of the government toward investigating the problem. The Swedish grocery chain Coop is the largest known victim. It closed most of its about 800 stores all day Saturday. Its registers were controlled online by Visma Escom, V-I-S-M-A-E-S-S-C-O-M, a Kaseya customer, and locked up and rendered unusable. Exactly how many systems have been infected is unknown, although the number is likely to be sizable. The cybersecurity firm Huntress, which is helping Kaseya's response, said it was aware of more than 1,000 businesses that had been affected. R-Evil's claim that it has compromised more than 1 million devices is impossible to prove because few victims are speaking publicly and no government or company has a database of everyone who was hit. But that number is plausible, said Mikko Hyponen, H-Y-P-P-O-N-E-N, a researcher at the cybersecurity company F-Secure, given that this strain of ransomware infects each device individually. Think about a retail chain like grocery retail, Hyponen said. Every single cashier system is an endpoint. Every laptop. Everybody in the sales has a system, multiple servers, 200 stores, 300 stores. They alone would have thousands of endpoints. And if 1,000 Coop-like companies were infected, yes, you would have 1 million endpoints. Regardless of the actual number of victims, it's extremely difficult to imagine victims banding together to jointly pay $70 million, said Alan Liska, L-I-S-K-A, an analyst at the cybersecurity firm Recorded Future. Despite the braggadocio in their note, I actually think it is actually a sign they are overwhelmed, Liska said. 1 million victims that each paid $45,000 would yield $45 billion, he noted. They are lowballing themselves at $70 million, he said. From TweakTown.com, new iOS update is nuking people's iPhone batteries. Here's the fix. Reports indicate that Apple's new iOS update, iOS 14.6, is causing people's iPhone batteries to be drained faster than usual. Article by Jack, J-A-K, Connor, C-O-N-N-O-R. Published Wednesday, July 7th. Back at the end of May, iOS 14.6 was released to the public, and since then, reports are surfacing about how the newest update is causing iPhone batteries to drain faster than usual. A new report from CNET states that several users have been saying that their iPhone's battery is draining a lot faster than it usually does since they updated their phone to iOS 14.6, and that this was most noticeable when using the podcast app. There was an extra when in there. iOS 14.6 ushered in new features for iPhone users, some of which are a new way to find lost AirTag trackers, Apple Card family, and more Apple Music support. CNET recommends that if you have noticed a drop in your iPhone's battery life, you should go to Settings, to Battery, to find any apps that are using excessive battery power. Once you have located those apps, it's up to you whether or not you want to close or remove them to fix the problem. For more information on this story, check out the hot link. The Jack joined the Tweaktown team in 2017 and has since reviewed hundreds of new tech products and kept us informed daily on the latest news. Jack's love for technology, and more specifically PC gaming, began at 10 years old. It was the day his dad showed him how to play Age of Empires on an old compact PC. That was my first, too. Ever since that day, Jack fell in love with games and the progression of the technology industry in all its forms. Instead of typical FPS, Jack holds a very special spot in his heart for RTS games. From NewsObserver.com on July 7th, if you have an Android or Google phone or any other device that uses the Google Play App Store, you're likely the victim of a monopoly that's creating artificially high prices for apps, says a new lawsuit filed by 37 states. The title, "People Using the Google App Store Are Needlessly Paying Higher Prices," lawsuit says. Article by Will Duran. State attorneys general from around the country sued Google for antitrust violations on Wednesday in a case that could potentially bring millions of dollars back to North Carolina, both to the state and individual consumers. The lawsuit alleges Google is a monopoly and has used that status to unfairly restrict competition and options within the Google Play App Store. That, in turn, has created limited options and higher prices for all its customers, said North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein, who is among the officials leading the lawsuit. "We believe they're charging monopoly rents, which means they're charging a gross overcharge on consumers," Stein said in an interview. "Because they can. Because they are a monopoly. And they're using that monopoly power to the detriment of users." In a lengthy response posted Wednesday night, Google disputed the claims and called the lawsuit meritless. The company is hardly a monopoly, it said, since it has to compete with Apple. Plus, phones and tablets that run Android allow apps to be downloaded outside the Google Play Store. Many devices also come preloaded with competing app stores like the Amazon App Store, Google said, giving customers further options. Stein acknowledged that Google does allow people to get around the Play Store, but he said people who try to do so are shown scary-sounding warnings about malware that he said are largely bogus. "The real intent is to convince people to use the Google Play Store," he said, adding that in the end, 90% of app downloads on Android devices do come through the Play Store. Follow the money. Google takes a large cut out of app purchases, Stein said Wednesday, which forces companies to not only make their apps more expensive, but also raise the cost of things that can be purchased within apps, like microtransactions in video games, which are a lucrative and ubiquitous part of the mobile gaming industry. Stein said Google charges as much as 30% for its cut. "When people buy things from payment processors, the typical rate is 3%, and Google is charging 30%, said Stein, a Democrat. "And so I'm bringing this lawsuit along with 36 other attorneys general, Republicans and Democrats alike, to stop Google from using its dominant market position in Android to harm consumers." Google has argued in state Senate hearings on antitrust that the fees help support Play Store upgrades, tools for developers, and security updates. Google has not yet responded to a request for comment on Wednesday. The four main leaders of the lawsuit are Utah, North Carolina, Tennessee, and New York. Stein and North Carolina were also among the leaders in a different multi-state lawsuit against Google last December. That previous lawsuit argued that Google used its dominance over internet searches to corner the lucrative online advertising market. The company would lower the search rankings for competitors like home repair search sites, the lawsuit said, and its search results favor companies that advertise with Google and not other search engines like Bing. Similarity to Fortnite lawsuits. The lawsuit could resonate locally where Cary-based Epic Games has sparred with tech giants over similar complaints. Epic sued Google as well as Apple last year with similar claims, arguing the company's App Store practices were a violation of antitrust laws. Both Google and Apple kicked Epic's popular Fortnite video game off their app stores after Epic tried to add its own payment processing system to the app, a move that violated App Store rules. But unlike the Fortnite lawsuits, the new one from the state could wind up with individual North Carolinians getting paid if a judge accepts the 37 states' request for damages and fees. The new lawsuit claims that nationwide people have paid about $32 billion at the Google Play Store. Stein said that by a rough estimate, North Carolinians might be responsible for around $1 billion of that. In addition to seeking damages for individual customers, the lawsuit is also seeking civil fees that would go to the states involved in the lawsuit. Epic declined to comment on the lawsuit from the attorneys generals, but Megan DiMuzio, executive director of the Coalition for App Fairness, a group co-founded by Epic, said it supported the lawsuits. App stores have been given a free pass to abuse their dominant market position for far too long, DiMuzio said in a statement. Their anti-competitive policies stifle innovation, inhibit consumer freedom, inflate costs, and limit transparent communication between developers and their customers. Google disagrees. The lawsuit filed Wednesday by the 37 states, it said, mimics a similarly meritless lawsuit filed by the large app developer Epic Games, which has benefited from Android's openness by distributing its Fortnite app outside of Google Play. But while Epic has sued both Google and Apple, so far North Carolina has not filed a suit against Apple's App Store. But Stein said that's not out of the question in the future. We are clearly monitoring the Epic versus Apple case closely and may choose to pursue a similar case against Apple if we believe that the facts warrant it and that the relief granted is inadequate, Stein said. Apple also charges a 30% fee on in-app purchases, which Epic argues causes prices to be artificially high. We believe this form of tying of a mandatory payment service with a 30% fee is illegal in the case of a distribution platform with over 50% market share, Tim Sweeney, Epic's founder and CEO, said last year. Rebecca Haw-Allensworth, a professor of antitrust at Vanderbilt Law School, said Epic could benefit from a broad antitrust push against Google. I think this is what Epic wants, she said in a phone interview. I think one of Epic's goals in bringing the suit was to get the attention of other regulators and to try to get them to jump on the bandwagon. The addition of 37 attorneys general, she said, will make it seem less like Epic is on its own with this issue. It's not clear that it would be the kind of thing that would be cited by the courts in deciding in favor of Epic, she added, noting she hasn't read the complaint yet. But the optics and the position of the rest of the regulators will influence judges. Of course, Epic also stands to benefit if the attorneys general win any remedies against Google, she added. Epic's lawsuit with Google could go to trial next year. However, its case against Apple could be decided soon, with a judge expected to reach a decision in the coming weeks. Epic is hoping to convince the court that app developers should be allowed to have more than one way to get their apps into iPhones. Currently, the only option is through the App Store, and that they should be allowed to use any payment system they desire. Apple argues that it should be allowed to have both higher fees and restrictions on its App Store because of the security and user experience it provides customers. Unlike Apple, Google does allow apps to be downloaded outside of its App Store in a process called sideloading. As Google has said, its sideloading feature is proof that there are multiple distribution channels on Android. But Epic has argued in its lawsuit that Google makes the process intentionally cumbersome, so that apps downloaded outside of the Play Store are put at a disadvantage. Stein said that feature doesn't negate the antitrust complaints against the Play Store. They make it exceptionally difficult for people to be able to download any app other than through their Play Store, he said, adding they make users go through multiple steps and many scary warnings about the risks that they are creating for themselves that we believe are not real. And so we just believe it's not an actual meaningful opportunity, and it's shown by the fact that Google Play Store is where more than 90% of downloads occur. This is a developing story. Check back for updates. The story was produced with financial support from a coalition of partners led by Innovate Raleigh as part of an independent journalism fellowship program. The NNO maintains full editorial control of the work, and there is a hot link for that. In a post to the NOPBC, National Organization of Parents of Blind Children, from Ozzie M. Howe, H-O-W-E, not quite related to parenting a blind child, however, I hope it helps parents and to aid their blind children in their explorations. Whether it's a first white cane or trying to find a white cane that will survive middle school kids jumping over the cane as you try to walk down the hall. I've been coming across a lot of people asking about differences in canes and wanted to try to circulate a post I wrote on canes a few years back. The biggest thing to keep in mind is what's right for one might not be right for you. There are all sorts of companies, styles, philosophies, and so on. I'm going to give you as much of an explanation as I can on the differences. Lengths. When I started to get mobility lessons, I was told that the cane should meet the middle of my chest. When I didn't know any other opinions, I made it work. However, I found I had to hold the cane out almost at full arm's length to avoid tripping when walking at my full stride. Later on, I was told by NFB members that I should have a cane that reaches my nose. That made my life a lot easier for a while, and I was able to walk more comfortably. After I was comfortable with that and built up my confidence, I was asked to try an even longer cane, aiming for the middle of my forehead. That was excellent for me, but unfortunately makes it difficult for me to find a cane properly sized for my height. I'm 6'8" tall. Company differences. Ambutech have really heavy canes. I personally find them to be too much on the wrist. I can use one for a while, but after a couple of days of constant use, I start feeling pain. However, they are a lot less likely to break if you're the type who's hard on your cane, getting them closed indoors, stuck in gutters, etc. Revolution are really nice canes. They are lighter than most canes I've tried, and they come with a lifetime warranty. They're also cheaper than most other companies. The problem I've had with them is that they have rather loose connection points between sections if you get a folding cane, and they have a lot of connection points. Between both of those facts, you lose a lot of tactile feedback. Europa have strong connections between sections, but they tend to sharpen over time. Those sharpening edges cut through the cord really fast when compared to other canes. NFB have lightweight canes, but in my experience, they tend to break the easiest due to the lighter weight materials. Given you can get a free NFB cane every 6 months or a year, I forget which, that's a reasonable trade-off in my personal opinion. Bob Riley canes are rather interesting. They are strong, reasonably weighted, etc. However, I'm personally not a fan due to their flexibility. For some people, the flexibility is great. It helps avoid breaking if you're the type to get your cane stuck in gutters. But I'm not comfortable with how much the cane flexes as I'm walking. Outdated, but still useful, as the design was picked up by another company. Unfortunately, I don't remember the name to change it in the post. Styles of canes. There are three common styles of canes, including straight, folding, and telescoping. Each style has its benefits and its drawbacks. Straight canes give the most feedback, tend to be the lightest, and have the most flexibility. On the other hand, they don't shrink in size, which means you have to figure out how to store your cane when you're in a vehicle, sitting at a restaurant, and so on. Folding canes lose tactile feedback at every connection point. It isn't a whole lot per point, but a little bit per connection fold. The more folds, the less tactile feedback you get. While the more folds it has, the smaller the cane is when you store it. My old boss had a cane that folded into 8 sections when folded, was the size of a 12-ounce soda can. The final of these three is the telescoping cane. A telescoping cane is more or less the happy medium between a straight cane and a folding cane. The tactile feedback is degraded slightly because of there are breaks, but not as many as a folding cane. The big hang-up with the telescoping cane is how easily they tend to jam. You get a little bit of dirt inside the cane and you could jam it, stopping the cane from collapsing properly. Then the other side of the same equation is how easily they collapse. I have never had it happen to me personally, but I've heard plenty of complaints that someone is using their telescoping cane, hit a gutter the wrong way, and it collapsed. Grips. The grip is 100% personal choice. I was never a fan of the ridged grips. I know they're designed to make a better grip, but I prefer a smooth rubber grip. Cane tips. A rolling tip, marshmallow tip, will help if you're the type to drag your cane, but it makes the cane heavier, off-balancing it a bit if you're going to use a tap method. A pencil tip makes the least difference to weight distribution. A teardrop tip adds weight to the end on the ground and helps with a drag method. And I've run out of time. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you enjoyed Vision News. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, Doris Hyde. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Vision News is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Please call 919-832-5138 with comments and questions. Thank you for listening to North Carolina Reading